You know, finances, you and I have been talking about, because a year ago we bought a printing company, and boy, when you talk about $30,000+ worth of paper and that goes on, that finances are amazing. And you see what goes out the front door, and you're praying that something comes in the front there. And
in the back door.
Yeah, see what, or vice versa, whatever, the side door. Just, yeah, print more stuff. We have a gentleman with us today. We're going to talk about that, an interesting title to his book, which we'll get to, Shane Enette. Good morning, Shane. Welcome to Good Morning Ozarks.
Good morning. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for having me.
It is our pleasure. Before we even talk about the subject and how it got about and what have you, we always want to find out about folks and where they were born and grew up, and would you mind giving us that information?
Sure. My first 8 years was in Dallas. My parents went to Dallas Seminary, and then, you know, while they were in seminary, they started having us, and they were both from California. And my sister, when I was about 8, she came running over to my mom and said, "Ma, Pa, I'm fixing to go over yonder." And my parents were like, "We should get back to California."
What part of California, Shane, were they from?
My mom grew up in a place called Downey, which is just outside of L.A.
Sure, and close to Disneyland.
Yes. And that's currently I live right next to the Biola campus, which is in La Mirada, which is near Long Beach.
Yeah, sure.
And then I grew up in a place called Cypress, which is where Tiger Woods grew up, and kind of near that whole area.
Well, I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, so I know where you're speaking of. Now, are you out there now?
Yes.
The Attaboy Award because you're in that Pacific time zone, so it's a little after 5:30 where you're at, Shane.
It is.
So tell me about, so you finished high school out there, I guess, and then on to college. What college did you go to?
Yeah, so I ended up going to USC, University of Southern California, and did grad school at North Carolina, so I had to tell people, you know, I went to the real USC, not the other USC, but yeah, sure. So did undergrad in LA and in USC, and then worked in the industry in San Diego and LA, and have been kind of in this SoCal area ever since.
What industry did you work in?
I was valuing stocks. I was working for a mutual fund company, and I did investment consulting for large pensions and endowments.
Mm. Tell me about your faith story. It sounds like since your folks went to the seminary, there probably was some of that.
Yeah, so grew up in a Christian household, but really my faith was cultural, just something to do to please the parents. And, you know, Jesus wasn't personal. I remember thinking I knew everything there was to know about the Bible when I was around 10 and being very proud of that.
Right.
And then when I was 13, I got into this accident where I was climbing the side of the house to get onto the balcony on a tree, and I'd locked myself out, and I fell two stories onto an iron rod fence, and then they rushed me to the hospital, and I should have died, but God kind of kept me alive, and, you know, surgeries, and they had this, one of the spikes had kind of gone in my body, but they were so proud I was still alive. The surgeon wanted to keep the spike, but I still have it.
oh, my.
And when I was in that hospital room, I could sense the presence of God, this incredibly personal presence of the King of the Universe. And he was in the right side of the room, and I could feel his smile. And it was a taste of unfavored love, of just an incredible personal relationship that I still can taste to this day, and nothing compares to that. And so I, you know, became passionate about following the Lord in that moment and in that time of being in the hospital. I had nothing to offer God, but he just loved me. And so that set me on the path that was a bit of a conflicting path, because I actually started to love the learning of management and money around age 15 when I got a book about investing. And so as I got deep into investing, and I started leading teen investing seminars, and really just loved to learn and teach this subject, it seemed like it was at conflict with my faith and my my love for Jesus and all of the stories of abandoning everything and, you know, loving Jesus, which meant trust and meant kind of seemed like it meant not growing any type of wealth, not learning about managing money. So this book really is in response to how to like build a bridge between the language of faith and being radically loving of Jesus with taking seriously our role as a steward of God's money.
You know, some folks, Shane, they find a deeper relationship with the Lord after once coming to know him at a church service, and they go forward, or they're at a campfire, and, you know, they just have a deep relationship. But, man, you went through something, but he sure found you right in that hospital room in a way that you know that you know that you know who he is and what he is about, and that's awesome.
Yeah, it was a great gift.
That is cool. Hey, before we talk about the financial situation, because I know we're going to get there, but you mentioned SC, and I had just said earlier that they've canceled their graduation, which you probably had been involved in at some time, because of these demonstrations, what have you. Now, you for a moment could be our on-scene correspondent from KLFC. Give me the... You know, you hear all the stuff on the news, and sometimes we found out that isn't exactly the way it is, or it's puffed up, or what have you. Can you, from a standpoint of somebody knowing the college and being there, tell me about that?
I know it's so interesting to see my college, you know, on these national news stories and probably worldwide news stories. And, you know, my understanding is largely based on how the news has been presenting the information, but I do know USC culture pretty well. I don't know if you know this, but it's consistently listed as the top school for international students. They have the most amount of international students in the nation.
I didn't know that.
So they have this huge amount of students, particularly from the kind of the Asian areas of China and India, but then they also have a lot of Middle Eastern students, and so you have this incredible melting pot of cultures that are at USC, and the valedictorian this year just happened to be kind of this, I think she's an engineer, and she was a Muslim background. And she looked really kind. I don't know, you know, just the looks of it. She looked like a very nice person. But then she'd been posting things on her social media in favor of a lot of, you know, Hamas and pro-Palestinian kind of groups. And so the, you know, Israeli, or at least the pro-Jewish Israeli student bodies kind of helped administration see that what was going on. And so they... you know, they researched it and then recognized that this was a bit of a security threat. So they said, you know, this isn't protected under free speech to be a speaker at the commencement. So let's go ahead and not have you, because we don't want to risk anything. And then that kind of started the cascade of events to where they then stopped. They just wanted to have the speakers be protected. So they didn't have them. And then just recently, I mean, yesterday, they said, let's just not have the commencement at all. And I think it's largely in response to all the demonstrations that are going on across the nation right now. I know in Southern California is less charged with this topic than Northern California. So like a Berkeley, they tend to get a little more, dangerous.
Sure.
LA tends to have a pretty strong Jewish community, very strong Hasidic Jewish community, and then there's a lot of diversity. So you have lots of Palestinian communities as well, but the Jewish community, particularly in LA, is very, very strong. So I haven't seen things don't tend to get kind of too crazy at UCLA a little bit, but not USC. USC is a little bit more, a little bit more on the conservative side, which I don't know if you noticed, but USC used to be called the Fighting Methodist.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and unfortunately, once you get me going on USC, I don't stop with all of the facts, and I, I feel like one of my missed careers was to be a walking guide tour for USC.
I think you would be good, Shane, doing that. I remember one of my highlights in high school when I was in the marching band out at Birmingham in the Valley. We marched at the Coliseum for a USC game, and it was just, man, what was exciting. And then the guy on the horse and all that jazz. It was great. So I followed USC from that. Is this the first time in your knowledge that they've just canceled that big event? I mean, 6,000 people go to it? My goodness.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I mean, and I was excited about this year's speaker, John Chu. He was the director of Crazy Rich Asians, and he was actually in my friend circle. So, you know, I remember talking to him, and, you know, USC is really, really, it has incredible cinema. They're the number one in the world on producing movies. And, and so that speaker was, he was going to be great. And it's a huge event, their commencement, and they always do a great job. And I 100% agree with them to kind of cancel it, but it's obviously sad for all of the graduates.
Sure, and, you know, there is a whole deal there with what can, you know, free speech, but it gets out of hand when you have groups demonstrating and saying, down with America, and, you know, going against what has historically been our ally, you know, Israel. And if we ever move away from that, it will be tragic. I appreciate it, Shane. Thank you for your insight on that. Now let's turn to the book. How did the book come about for you?
Yeah, so as I was kind of mentioning, I was, you know, I was deep in this relationship with Jesus, and, you know, I'm like, I see the authentic follower of Christ as someone that just leaves their, you know, boat full of fish and just has their eyes, you know, on Jesus and says, I'll do anything. And that seemed incompatible with all of his learning about finance and investing, where you create a financial plan, you grow money over time, you have, you're careful, you know, you're thoughtful about what you're doing. And so as I was growing, I'm like, it can't be that you just don't learn about finance and investing as a Christian. But I didn't see any help. There was nobody talking about how, as a Christian, you should, you know, love Jesus and learn about money at the same time. It seemed like there was just two different worlds. Like, you learn about the world of money and wear that suit, and then take that suit off and walk over to church, and then you know, worship Jesus. And these two worlds should not really join together. God, Jesus is spiritual, this is physical, so let's just kind of keep those two worlds apart. And so my book is a desire of seeing money as this great pathway, this great highway to God's heart, because it's so connected to your heart, and he wants our hearts. And so when with money, we care about it deeply, and we should never be keeping that from our relationship with Jesus. And when we include Jesus with this love that we have to, you know, to take care of ourselves, and with this, you know, where our treasure is, there our heart is, when Jesus becomes a part of our money lives, then we get to love him at a deeper level, and we just can't have him be a threat. And if he's a threat, if we're worried that he's just going to tell us to give everything away and don't worry about this whole money thing, don't grow in your stewardship skills, then we end up getting fractured hearts. So the goal of the book is, I just want to help Christians see money as a pathway towards loving God deeper with more of a whole heart.
Well, you know, the Bible, that people interpret that the Bible says the love of money is the root of all evil. The love is, perhaps, but money isn't evil. It's what we do with it. And one of the things that I've learned is that you can give it and you can keep it both. And I know that you're going to tell us about that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, it's not the money, you know, and Dallas Willard, I don't know if you know, he was a philosopher at USC.
At USC, there you go.
bring it back. he has a great essay on wealth, and he says that during Jesus' time, the Jewish church, they felt like wealth signaled God's favor. And if you had wealth, that meant you were more spiritual, because wealth was the key to fulfilling the commission to, you know, the creation mandate. To fill the earth and show God's image. And so wealth was going to be helped to do that. And so obviously if you had wealth, you were more spiritual because God was choosing you to kind of fulfill his commands. And so when Jesus went out and said, like, it's, you know, harder for the rich to get into heaven as a camel to go through the eye of needle, it was shocking because they're like, wait, money isn't how you get spiritual. And so now in today's culture, we flipped it and we said, it's actually poverty that makes you spiritual, and wealth is something that makes that if you have money, you must be unspiritual. And so it's shocking, this idea that you could actually have wealth and not and be spiritual at the same time. And that in general, wealth itself is not a lever you pull to get more or less spiritual. It's your heart. You know, as you were saying, the love of money is the problem, not whether there's money or not money.
Let's open up the pages of your book and go through some chapters. What was the hardest chapter for you to write? And tell me about the one that's your favorite. Maybe they're the same, but kind of walk through it a little bit, some of the chapters, and give us a golden nugget to take away from this interview.
Yeah, I'd say definitely the first chapter was the hardest for me to write. I dared to ask the question of, should I give all my money away? And this is a hard chapter for me because, whenever I ask someone, what would Jesus do if you walked up to him and you honestly showed him your bank statement, showed him your financial plan, if you have one, or just, you know, showed you your hopes and dreams about money, you know, having some, being able to take care of yourself, all that. Most people would assume that Jesus would say, this is something that is not good. You should, I had an alarm call. Most people would assume, Jesus would say, you know, that wealth stuff, just get rid of it. Like that's in the way between me and you. I care about your soul. You shouldn't worry about this money stuff. And so the trite response to that would say, no, money's important. Now here's all your steps to, you know, learning about money. But I didn't want to just have a trite response to that worry. And I wanted to actually enter into that question of what is this deal with this idea of this worry about, you know, having possessions and whether that could hurt our hearts. And I don't want to sacrifice this idea of being abandoned to Jesus and truly being a follower of him and not having wealth be an obstacle. So the book, the first chapter really kind of walks through just an honest exploration without just casting that question aside. And then it also ends with this idea of everything being us as Christians being the grace. Because I really want people to enter into that question, and I want some to actually respond with a radical generosity that is like Zacchaeus, who says, I'll sell half of my wealth. and there are others where that's just a beautiful response to encountering Christ, is to give away most of your possessions. But for most of us, it's not going to be to abandon all possessions, but it's going to be to love Jesus and then figure out how our possessions can be used in order to excel in our giving. So that was the hardest one, just because I really want people to enter into that and then see its grace and then respond in the way that God's calling them to, without telling them what to do.
What do you think the favorite chapter that you wrote was?
I know that's a fun question. I really like talking about money personalities. So chapter 7, I really think it's important for us to understand that our family of origin and our personality, our natural dispositions, they all kind of work towards what's called a money personality. And that can either, if it's healthy, it makes our plans go well, our budgets go well. If it's unhealthy, then no matter how much we plan or budget, things will kind of go off the rails.
Let's talk about money. You coined the phrase there, money personality. Define those differences for me, if you will.
Sure. So there's different ways of defining it. I have two different systems from two different academics. first one, Dr. Miriam Tatzel, she talks about money worlds. And so you can put everyone on a 2x2 grid of whether they're tight or loose with money. And this is just natural. And so to be tight means spending money is a bit painful. You tend to view price as always negative, which means if something's cheaper, it's always better. If something's more expensive, it's always worse. Yeah. And then if you're loose, then you see price in a positive kind of relationship where the more expensive something is, it must be better, and so you want it more because it's a, you know, and spending money tends to be enjoyable because you're getting things that are good. And so then the other dimension is, or the other type of, it's a dimension is whether you're high or low in materialism. And that just means whether you experience the world through material things. So it's not bad or good. It's just some people, the way they're wired, they want to encounter and enjoy life through the things of life. Whereas other people, they're going to be low in materialism in that they kind of are more geared at experiences and kind of nature and things that are more transcendent. So given being high or low in materialism and tight or loose with money, you have a type of money world. And so if you're a value seeker, you're tight with money and you're high in materialism. So that's my wife. So she likes nice things, but she also doesn't like spending money. And so she ends up doing extensive researching and saving in order to buy nice things.
Well, she sounds like she might be one that would visit the thrift store or check things when they're on sale, right?
Exactly, and spend a lot of time looking in and then getting a great thing, but then also at a good price. And if you're tight with money and low in materialism, you become a non-spender, or you just are a non-spender, and that's someone that, you know, just shopping is painful, will avoid it if they can. And when I'm unhealthy in my money world, that's what I am. And then when I'm healthy, I loosen up. So I kind of, if I'm unhealthy, I get tight with money. And then when I'm healthy, I loosen up. And I don't change whether, I'm just naturally low in materialism. I really don't like cars. And I don't like, most of my possessions are kind of a burden. I'd rather not have them, but I need them. And so if you're loose with money and low in materialism, you're an experiencer. So you value kind of experiences above any kind of possessions. And you want to kind of spend on things that lead to growth and development. This is a very common money world for Gen Zers and millennials. And then if you're loose with money and high in materialism, you're a big spender. That's fine if you are, but it's a bit of a dangerous money world because that tends to lead towards debt.
What do you deal with in the book about debt and its pros and cons?
Yeah, so I have three different chapters on debts. I try and help people see the predatory nature of credit cards and payday loans and a lot of the lenders, particularly credit cards, that this. It's a hidden predator because the service itself is separating out the consequence of spending. Even if you pay your balance at the end of the month when you use a credit card, you're making spending more enjoyable because you're delaying the consequence. And so when you can swipe and buy something and not really see the price, not really have to dole out the cash, which is kind of painful when you see what's going out, then you actually create a hit of dopamine when you shop, when you don't see the consequence right away. And that actually often will create more enjoyment of shopping, which then will increase your spending and your credit card balance. And as it turns out, as you're delaying this consequence, you're increasing your spending, and then they will anchor you to the minimum payment. They'll show you this nice small number, and then when you see a small number, let's say $75 minimum payment, and then you see the full credit card balance, and the average American has a credit card balance of $5,000, then it's too big of a shift for your brain to go from $75 to $5,000. And so then, you know, more than 75% of Americans don't pay their full credit card balance. And I think it's because credit card companies are taking advantage of our human psychology. And And so you get trapped, you get stuck in this debt, and because it will grow exponentially against you. And as a Christian, we shouldn't get stuck in debt because we're less free to be generous, to do the work of God with the money he's entrusted in us.
Well, what's the healthy takeaway that you want people to learn from reading this book?
I'd say what I would love people to learn is, the Bible talks about money. It's the second most discussed topic in the Bible with 2,100 verses. And if you kind of look, the main theme is that with money and possessions, Paul in 2 Corinthians, he says, you know what, with money, you should just excel in the grace of giving. And in love, he coins that phrase, grace of giving. And then he says, this isn't a commandment. This is just something that benefits you. And I think in the same way, we should say, all right, with this money that I'm receiving, I should make a financial plan and a spending plan to allow me to excel. And I think things like that you learn in this book, like an 800 credit score and digital envelopes and a good spending plan and faith-based ETFs, these different kind of saving and spending tools will help you move towards being intentional to where, you know, you get to excel in giving, which really benefits you and draws you closer to Jesus because you're doing this alongside him as someone in Christ seeking to show the world who he's like, and he's a very generous person.
Amen. Where is this book available, Shane?
Amazon, you can get it there, physical or Kindle, as well as Tyndale's website.
Okay, very good. And the title of it is?
Whole Heart Finances, a Jesus-centered guide to managing your money with joy.
Sounds good. Got anywhere to go in the next 10 minutes, or could you give us a little bit more time after the break?
Yeah, I can give some more time if needed.
All right, grab a cup of coffee or what have you. You get the Attaboy Award for being in the Pacific time zone out in California. Thank you so much for doing that. Think about what you could tell us, if you know anything, about where you think our physical money is going as it relates to the digital money that we've heard a lot about. And if you don't know about that, we'll jump back into a chapter. All right, Shane, stay with us. It is Good Morning Ozarks with Keith and Kathy this morning, and we've got 54 degrees. So you stay with us as well here at the Round Table on Good Morning Ozarks on Life FM. Welcome to the 8 o'clock half hour of Good Morning Ozarks. Keith O'Neill and Kathy O'Neill for Charlie today. He'll be back on Monday after a week of having a sibling outing up the Lake of the Ozarks area, and that'll be fun. Let's see how many games of cards or dominoes he won, or hoped he won. So he'll be back on Monday. If you missed the last half hour, I encourage you to go to klfcradio.com later today, about 11 o'clock our time, about 9 o'clock out in California. And you could listen to the podcast of what Shane Enet had to have to say. Did I get that right, Shane?
Yeah. You know, I'm not consistent. So you actually said it the way that I say it, both Enet and Enet.
Yeah.
Okay. Both are good.
Let me ask you, what kind of, where does that name come from? Where does your family, if you go way back in the Enet side,
All right, so I have two tales to spin on it. I'll be quick, but it's French. It's two French words, en été, which is in summer. Mm. And I ask people from France, have you heard of this name? And they kind of laugh and say it's kind of a ridiculous name, you know. and so we can trace our lineage to the Louisiana Purchase. So I think my distance family history, I think they were running from the law and changed their names to, and so they either was religious persecution or they were, you know, criminals. Right. So I'm going to go with religious persecution.
Okay, we'll take that one. with my family, they've been moonshiners, so maybe we're related back there somewhere.
I did discover I was related to Patrick Swayze by marriage the year he died, so I was not able to take advantage of that.
Wow. Huh. That's pretty cool. And then your other side of the story was, you said there were two stories.
No, he did.
Well,
or it was both two sides.
Criminal or, yeah.
Oh, okay. Two sides of that story. Yeah. All right, gotcha. Yeah. Shane, I had asked you before the break about this whole thing that we're hearing having to do with cash and our money that we use, and digital money.
Yeah. Yep.
From your standpoint, you're kind of you're swimming that financial pond more than Kathy or I do. What do you think? Is it going to happen? Should it happen? And I have definite views about that one.
Yeah.
But, you know, what do you think is our future as far as digital money is concerned?
Yeah, it's kind of like a tide that's coming in, and it's like, can you stop it? I don't think so. There's, you know, neat benefits of physical money. The one thing that, just from a cleanliness perspective, money's dirty.
Yeah,
like physical
true.
Money's very dirty, and so much of it, it seems like a waste. Because it just gets thrown away, and you know, I don't know if you've seen all of the studies of just how dirty money gets and how much waste and money is spent to form the printing of money. So from that perspective, it's nice just to kind of let that go to the wayside. But then, you know, if you lose physical money, you lose security. You know, you lose a sense of agency, and you lose a sense of autonomy. Of control, which both psychologically and just practically is nice to be able to have physical money. I do think it's just a matter of time before physical money is phased out. And it, you know, there'll be benefits for only transacting. We're basically there where we're mostly just transacting in a virtual world with our Apple Pay and our watches and...
Sure.
And so there's that kind of practical side that I will say that the more everything becomes digital, the less sensitive we are to prices. And so we spend more, we get into more debt. There's just that natural consequence of having everything be digital, you know, zeros and ones. Whereas with cash, it's so easy to physically see what's going on and you actually have a better sense of what things cost. And with our kids, you know, my wife and I, we have this debate all the time, you know, because I want them to be on a budget system to learn, you know, we use a budget system called YNAB, which is you need a budget, and it's an app, and I want our kids, like, getting savvy with these budget apps. But then my wife, Tammy, is like, well, they won't see, you know, the realness of money because they need to actually have dollar bills and coins and, you know, learn that money is actually can be physical and it's a real thing. It's not just zeros and ones. So I go back and forth on the virtue and the vice of having digital money.
Do you think that it is like imminent, you know, next year or so? I get these emails. They're trying to sell you something, of course, that say, you know, they could announce digital money on May 30th and so on and so forth. I know they're sales pitches, but is there any truth to imminent changeover, do you think? Or are we looking at something that, you know, is 10, 15 years down the pipe?
Yeah, I think imminently they'll introduce some kind of products that will be very low, you know, very small adoption and take a long time to kind of phase in. That'll take that 10 years. So I think, you know, because a lot of countries have already, like China, have introduced a digital currency, and it's just whether it's fully adopted or not. And there's no way that they can just introduce it and then phase out physical currency within a year. That would cause a crazy amount of social instability. I think imminently we'll get introduced something, but the adoption of it will take a while. I'm saying a decade would probably be the length of time for adoption.
Hmm. Will the ability of the powers be there to command us to spend money a certain way?
I know, it's interesting. So one area that is going to be the first area where they'll actually command it is in retirement. And I'm mixed on this. You may notice a theme with, I tend to want to see the benefits of both sides, with retirement is an incredible crisis. The average person in their 60s has about, $900 saved for their next 20, 30 years. And so how do we get people to save for retirement? The government could institute a nationwide IRA kind of program, and they've been kind of talking about this, where every amount of earned income, just like Social Security, is forced to go into the Social Security system. They could force money going into an IRA separate account kind of system. And that would be the first thing I think the government would do.
And then they can take it from it like they did the Social Security. That's irritating.
Yeah, and unlike, so Social Security is commingled, you know, it's like pooled together, and so it's easier to take that because no one really has a separate account. But this would be an actual separate account, and so for them to take that, which they still could, it would be a little bit harder. But you've seen other countries like in Lebanon and in Greece where people had separate bank accounts, and the government just kind of took from that to pay their kind of debts.
It depends on who's in charge.
Yeah, it sounds like a slippery slope that, you know.
You're right.
I remember back in the 60s in California where I got saved, and there was a gentleman, Willard Cantillon, that was big in those days, and he was talking about one day, he's prophesying basically, one day we will have a cashless society. And that was pre MasterCard and Visa. So people said, no, that'll never happen. Now, look, you know, we have a printing company here in Branson, and I would say 80%, if not more, of our business that comes through the front door, people pay with a credit card. So we certainly understand that we're more there than not. And we really appreciate your insights, and we appreciate your book. Tell us one more time where to get it, the title, and you have a second volume or more books on your desk?
Yeah, so the book is Whole Heart Finances, Amazon or Tyndale's websites, you can get it. I have 7 book projects that are too many.
Yeah.
I would love to write something, a children's book, a type of allegory or analogies, stories that help teach kids about money. I would love to write a book kind of that talks about investing, and in this, my book has a couple chapters on saving and investing, but I would love to do a whole book on, because that's my main area of expertise, particularly on the faith-driven investing community and the biblically responsible investing. And there's more projects that I would love to do.
Well, you're a busy guy. And have you ever been to our part of the country?
You know, I have not. And I went to Kansas State for a PhD, so I was up in Manhattan.
Right.
But I was in Texas. But yeah, I did. I haven't hit that whole kind of Missouri, Oklahoma, Arkansas kind of spot.
Well, come see us in the Ozarks. It's a beautiful country. The two things I miss about California is the weather and the beach. So can't bring those with you, but thank you very much for being with us this morning, and come see us back here in the Ozarks.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, Shane.
Nice to talk to you,
We'll talk with you again in the future when one of those 7 books comes out. Keep in touch.
Okay.
All right, God bless you.